Hello, and welcome to Spartan Speak, a podcast from the Lansing State Journal and Detroit Free Press focused on Michigan State sports. I'm Phil Friend, your host, podcast producer, and sports writer for the LSJ, joined by Free Beat writer Chris Solari and LSJ sports columnist Graham Couch. Gentlemen, there is absolutely nothing going on in the world of college football right now, is there? Especially when it pertains to the Big Ten and somehow the President of the United States.
Yeah, well,
there's actually some football games, too.
That's true. There are games, and there's, I mean, it's one of those things where you think you might get a quiet week for a minute. Sort of things have been said, things have been spoken. It doesn't look like there's going to be a development. And then a Tuesday happens, and there's all sorts of sourcing and rumors, and the president's talking to the commissioner and saying the Big Ten's on the one-yard line, and you've got the Dan Patrick Show sourcing people that it's, you know, it's October 10th is the dream. And what's pretty clear here is there are a lot of people who would like to be playing October 10th. And the question is, you know, what the powers that be will want eventually. And there's been no evidence to this point that the presidents, and they'll need, I think, what, six of them to swing their vote the other way, would say that they want to that they're ready to do that. And that's when it really, when you start getting presidents and sources on presidents who are not Ohio State, Iowa, or Nebraska, and they are, you know, like even Purdue's president speaks up, and there's a little bit of, you know, there seems to be not a door that's closed there entirely. When you start to get more of that, then talk to me.
Yeah, I went back and kind of dug through a lot of the presidential quotes that we've seen from around the Big Ten in a subscriber story that posted Wednesday. And, you know, it's pretty marked, the difference between some of those presidents. I think the one situation where you might see someone who could continue, who can consider flipping, might be Penn State's Eric Barron, but he hasn't spoken publicly. That's all been coming through his athletic director. So again, you're talking about a filter there that, as we've seen, you know, I think there was a reason that the Big Ten presidents kept the athletic directors and football coaches out of their meeting and decision to prevent this sort of strong-arming and influencing from going on without just looking at the hard data. And, you know, certainly it maybe even hard data is not the right word because it's so tenuous and fluid. But, you know, the October 10th date to me is a complete pipe dream. Now, there is one scenario where I could see that date being a potential, and that's to start a practice. Because if you go back this summer, and it's been a flood of news, the NCAA said they would need basically like a six-week run-up to get teams ready to play and compete. Well, if you extrapolate that out, that October 10th date out, 6 weeks, that's November 21st. That's the Saturday before Thanksgiving. That's kind of always been the earliest that we've heard anything from sources that the Big Ten could consider trying to make an earlier comeback in 2020 rather than in 2021. But I think everybody's still pushing and pointing towards January. And, you know, it's crazy, though. It is really a crazy time right now with so many people and so many different factions talking and not talking.
Yeah, I can't believe – I'm surprised none of the other three Power Five conferences have really kind of considered, you know, backing off on them. They're starting here in mid to late September here. So it really seems like no matter what's happening, whether it's Alabama or South Carolina or, you know, whoever else is, you know, Oklahoma State, I think, too, is in the mix there getting infections. You know, everyone's just kind of pushing forward. It would be interesting to see what happens as we get closer and closer to the beginning of those games.
Yeah, and what's going to be interesting, too, is for the Big Ten to do anything, there needs to be new information. They need to feel comfortable. I mean, they didn't explain themselves all that well, obviously, and they're taking a lot of heat for it with their decision to shut things down. And one of the things you heard a lot of was, and you've heard this from public health officials, and this is okay, this part of it, the fear of the unknown. And, you know, I know there are a lot of people when they hear, you know, fear, you can't live in fear, and you hear all this. Look, when public health scientists and officials, people have dedicated their life to protecting public health and studying it, fear the unknown, then that's okay to fear that. And it's okay to say that a little bit. So they'll have to have some sort of known that comes out of that. What wasn't known that you now feel okay about? And maybe I think the rapid testing is going to be something that could give them, you know, and Michigan State's president, Samuel Stanley, mentioned that. And I think that's one of the things that could give them, I don't want to say an out, but could help them push towards thinking differently if that's there for people. And because even be it November, be it January, whenever it is, there's going to have to be something that's different.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing I think that is going to be weighing in on these decisions for the Southern schools that are trying to push forward, how many of these guys are going to opt out? I mean, you've seen it at LSU. You know, as we start recording, if you remember the name Jamie Newman, it was the quarterback at Wake Forest. He transferred to Georgia. Well, he's opting out for COVID concerns as well. So, you know, as a lot of these programs get a little closer towards that kickoff date, how many guys are going to continue to do that? Not just at the top end, but other guys. You know, we saw it at Michigan State with guys like Marcel Lewis and Justin Stevens, younger guys that had some health concerns that they were worried might put them at risk. So, you know, that this is all going to be so fluid, including the rosters, including the games. You saw on Wednesday that Iowa State doubled back on their decision to have fans or at 25% capacity. Now they're going to have no fans. So, I mean, and I do think if there's one thing about the Big Ten putting a line in the sand and saying we're not going to play, it was in some ways to eliminate that stress factor on these kids of stopping, starting, up and down, the emotional roller coaster that they've really been on since March. Again, whether or not that's still going to be the right thing from a physical standpoint involving the decision not to play is one thing. But certainly these guys right now know that they're not starting the season on September 5th, which is this Saturday.
I think there are fewer – like, so there are some kids who have opted out, right? Some players have opted out. And we know the names, and they do it publicly. And there are some who have been very public in their desire to play. And I, you know, I think the vast majority are somewhere in between that, right? They don't love this. They wouldn't mind if things, they didn't play this year. They're not as enthusiastic as they would be normally, but they're not going to opt out. They don't either fear losing position or they just, that's just not in their nature or the, I think there is a number, you can sense a number of players, and just from people I've talked to that, you know, there are a lot of guys who wouldn't mind this season not happening. And if that's the case in the Big Ten, then I'm guessing it's the case a lot of places.
No, yeah. I completely agree with you. I mean, that's, you know, it's going to be interesting people watching from afar. Kind of seeing this transpire and coaches' reactions. And you know, I think Yahoo did a survey of 30 coaches about what they have to do differently. And there's a lot. There's a lot in terms of minimizing the playbook, smaller planning for smaller numbers and rosters and everything else. You know, it's going to be a challenge for these coaches that are trying to play.
I was just going to say, kind of coming back to the whole Big Ten thing, it should be announced since we last recorded. We're recording on Wednesday afternoon by now. I think we've said Wednesday a couple times here, so I think everybody's kind of on the same page there. Ever since we last recorded, the Big Ten did announce the official vote results between the presidents, with the coming out as 11-3 with Iowa and Nebraska voting to play the season in the fall as originally reported, and Ohio State also voted for it. I don't know. I wonder if from the Ohio State perspective, if that changed. If they just changed their vote at some point between the original 12-2 reporting and then made it 11-3, so that has happened. And then you will mention the Donald Trump thing to me in the telecast, or to me in the podcast. Excuse me. I mean, not to get too political on here, but it certainly seems like not a coincidence that he's targeting Big Ten country with his tweets and not the Pac-12, who is also not playing this fall.
No, there's no question to me that the political winds, you know, are. Look, this is a polarized country in an election year, and this is somehow we've wound up politicizing coronavirus, and that stinks. But there's no question that you know, that the president has reasons to want people in Michigan and Ohio and Wisconsin and places like Pennsylvania to like him and to sound like he is pushing for what they want, and certainly if there are voters who are, you know, on the fence on things, I would hope that would not be something that would swing somebody. If you're swung by whatever you think about all everything going on by the president, that tweet, that comment, then that's a pretty flimsy line that's pushing you one way or another. I think one of the things that I find frustrating, and is we hear from a lot of people about the idea that, you know, that they really want what's best for the student athlete and the fans and social media. And to me, and if you're coming from an angle that you just want college football, because you like college football, it's hard to listen to that argument. And because if you're really concerned about the student athlete and kids of that age and the opportunities and career growth, then you should be able to go back and find this similar concerns about minor league baseball players in June and May. And it's really not. I mean, a lot of people, they want their sports, and I get that. We all do. And I think one of the things that's, you know, Chris, we hear this all the time, that because a lot of this has been the bearer of bad news or the bearer of reasonable thought or whatever you want to call it, that we don't want a football season and we don't want to be covering sports. And I mean, I'll be frank. I wasn't excited about covering a COVID season that stops and starts, where every week it's not as fun to cover something via Zoom or press conferences. It's a harder thing to cover. But I mean, I love college football and I really love college hoops. And these have been staples of my life as long as I can remember. I mean, the ridiculous things I've worn and done in the backyard, pretending to be people when I was 6 years old. I mean, this is not like a part of my life that I want to see go away. And I don't think that is for any writer. And for a lot of people, it's their real livelihood concerns. And, but I also understand why sometimes it just feels like there's, I don't want to say a celebration of bad news, but you know, people jump on that, you know, everything seems like bad news and it seems like that's all people providing. And because we live in our own bubbles and everybody has their own slants on this, and somehow there are two sides to COVID, which is ridiculous. I understand why people see it that way too.
Yeah. And you know, I wrote about this summer. It's 25 years ago. It was the first I covered Michigan State football on the beat in college. And I've been covering football since my senior year in high school for my local paper in 1992. I mean, this is part of my life. This is part of your life. This is part of our jobs, the things that drew us into this profession in the first place. You know, the competition, the personalities, the game itself, the intrinsic beauty and ugliness that can come along with sports. I mean, it's, you know, there's so many things. It's funny. I was watching some reactions the other night from Michigan State in 2015, and that sheer joy of unexpectedness and sheer sadness of letdown. I mean, all these things that are such a part of the human condition that are, you know, that really sports is such a great escape from all these things in normal everyday life that, yeah, I mean, it is tough. It's tough to see that. It's tough to see these kids going through that, and it's tough to see these coaches whose livelihoods go through that. And, you know, and it's so much different, but at the same point, you know, we get piled on because we're kind of a conduit from the medical community. I mean, the sources within the medical community who've been gracious enough to give us their wisdom and insight. And you see it in a lot of different ways. I mean, there's not great news. And a lot of reason there's not great news is because there's a lot of research that needs to go on. And that's the nature of science. And that doesn't coexist with sports. You know, the nature of research doesn't really jive with sports, where you have a definitive outcome, where you have a fumble that even though the game's almost over and seems like it's over, it goes the other way. Science is a lot more fluid than that. There's no 60-minute clock to tell you it's over. You know, it's a constant evolving thing. And I think that's really the hard thing that people are dealing with in their everyday lives, but particularly with the sports life. You know, why is the baseball playing through this? Why is the NBA and NHL playing through this, in the NFL, and why not college sports? Why are high school sports doing it? I mean, there's so many different questions that everybody else has that we have that, you know, it's hard. It's a hard situation to kind of digest and really transmit to people. Probably not the right word during the middle of an epidemic, but, you know, it hasn't been a lot of good news, but you know, hopefully we continue to keep turning the corner medically and they can get back on the field in January or whenever they do.
Something we really haven't talked about yet, guys, is Kevin Warren. I know he has taken a brunt of the criticism from all angles. And do you guys feel like he has just handled everything poorly from day one? And then even when he's had a chance to, you know, kind of rectify things, and even when he's come out with explanations and the announcement of the vote, is it just a lost cause for him at this point in terms of getting the right messaging out? Or what can he do to kind of, you know, at least get enough people on the same page where he's just not receiving criticism from everybody, even writers, you know, and obviously fans, of course, you know, day in and day out?
So I'm a little bit sympathetic and then not sympathetic, because ultimately this is a presidential decision. It's not a Kevin Warren decision. And if, you know, if the president's wanted, it happens. If they don't, it doesn't. And I don't think the presidents have been that good. And I wrote about this for one column, just on the idea that this whole process should have been like a freaking school board meeting. Like, this is way too important from a public health standpoint. Forget football for a minute. If you've got information that deals with exertion and concerns of anything like that, then any random 40-year-old guy who might go out for a jog ought to know that. Every teacher ought to know that. Every parent ought to know that. I mean, these are not, we shouldn't be hiding this. This isn't a game, you know, defensive game plan for Penn State or something like that, right? So I've been frustrated across the board. With Kevin Warren, I mean, it started with that interview with Dave Revson on Big Ten Network. Because Revson, even though that's an internal sort of, it's not really, it's an internal arm of the Big Ten in some ways, I think pressed him somewhat and had a pretty good interview, and he just didn't offer anything. And there's just no reason for that. I don't understand why the information hasn't been. And I'm just one of those people who has very low toleration for poor communication. And I don't understand it. Because when I see it in jobs where people make a ton of money, I can point you to 15 friends who ought to have that job. Like, I mean, Kevin Warren probably does a lot of good things, but based on his performance recently, I got 15 friends I know personally who could handle this part of it better, because it's about communication and relationships and understanding how to take something and communicate it to the public. And that drives me absolutely insane. So I think he's done a miserable job at that. I don't have enough information because he hasn't been all that available. And we haven't heard, I don't know what's going on behind the scenes. He might be terrific. And he might be a terrific guy and a good leader in a lot of ways. But this has not been great. And you can't hide from this stuff. This isn't, this is closed practice.
I put a lot of the blame on the Big Ten office itself, not so much on Kevin Warren. I mean, he's kind of caught in the middle between the athletic powers that be that are speaking up. And, again, mind you, it's the guy that took over January 1st.
Yeah.
So it's not like he's got a wealth of experience. It's not like he came from another conference and had to deal with the media in a lot of these ways. I mean, he came from the NFL and he was more of a behind the scenes guy. The conference, I don't think, has done him any favors from the coaching and athletic department standpoint in airing their rift with the presidents. Some of the presidents not going out and giving any type of interviews or their rationale behind the vote. The Big Ten office itself saying there wasn't a vote, and then basically, oh yeah, by the way, there was actually a vote, essentially lying to members of the media about that, or at least misconstruing the fact. That puts a leader in a tough position, but ultimately the leader's in charge of them. But again, it's a guy that's from January 1st, but you're right with the Big Ten Network interview. There wasn't much of a plan. There wasn't much specificity there. I don't know if that was his reasoning, or I don't know if that was the president's rationale, but what really made the Big Ten look terrible across the board, presidents, chancellors, Kevin Warren, the rest of the administrators and media relations people in Chicago, is just how comprehensive the Pac-12 was with their plan and how transparent they were. They came out a day later and they had everything available to people to explain the decision, to explain why they weren't doing it, to give charts and graphs. I mean, the Big Ten didn't have that plan.
Here's the thing, though. Let me push back on you a little bit, Chris, here. And that's the one thing, like, So if the Pac-12, though, the Pac-12 did have quite a bit, I'm not sure that would have satisfied people around the Big Ten, because obviously it's a different level of rabid fan base, right? And basically, if we have the information on the Pac-12 and that were to satisfy people, that should have shut down every league, right? I mean, that should be enough. Look what the Pac-12 has here. Look what they've learned. And so, you know, I do think that there is going to be a side of things where people were just not satisfied, because you look at what we've seen from coaches and athletic directors, and just how fractured things have been in schools that are willing to speak out the other way. And some of it's politics and recruiting. Like Ryan Day, I was hearing, you know, I remember when Ohio State was looking on the fence, and I was hearing from people that Ryan Day can say whatever he wants and they can say whatever they want, but Ohio State's medical people, I felt a little differently. And if you're Ryan Day, you're trying to recruit, and you're trying to recruit against a lot of schools in the SEC that are playing. And so you're going to take that side regardless. But even so, the level of people thinking it's okay to source and share their opinions, and I mean it's unbelievable the different the factions that are coming out, and I think they're all beneath the presidential level, though.
With the Ohio State situation, that's really interesting to me, for a lot of different reasons. Phil kind of brought it up, you know, did they change their vote from a 12-2 to 11-3? Was it really 11-2 at that point? And was the new president, Christina Johnson, not involved in the meeting when they held their first vote? There's a lot of questions there that really, you know, again, not being answered, because they're picking and choosing. Here's the thing. Kevin Warren hasn't spoken to anybody within the communities in the Big Ten. That's a problem. That's a big problem. You can speak all you want on a national pulpit, but this is a decision that impacts the 14 communities that house these Big Ten schools, the businesses, the fans, the students, the athletes. A lot of questions still remain to be answered there. But you know, Ohio State, there was a story in the New York Times, I believe it was in late August, that their director of sports cardiology was doing a study and found more myocarditis in athletes. And it says, you know, the New York Times story said the survey found myocarditis in 15% of athletes who had the virus, who experienced no or mild symptoms. I mean, so that's, you know, you got to wonder, I mean, was that athletics pushing an issue to a new president and overriding the medical concern? I mean, there are so many questions that remain unanswered within the Big Ten, from a school by school basis and from a conference basis, that, you know, these leaders need to lead and answer.
Yeah, the Ohio State paradox is just such a weird thing. I mean, you can take it all the way back to when Jim Tressel was still there and he got in trouble, and then the Ohio State president made the comments that, you know, I have to do, I'm paraphrasing, basically said, Jim Tressel is my boss, and I kind of have to do what he wants. So I do kind of wonder, regarding the Kevin Warren comments, if he just felt like he didn't have to fully explain everything because he thought the other Power 5 conferences would eventually follow in line and everyone would sort of understand. That might be too simplistic, but there was a part of me that thinks he just thought everybody else would fall in line and he wouldn't have to explain himself all that much, unlike the Pac-10 or Pac-12, excuse me.
Yeah, I do think the Big Ten might have thought more people were going to come with them. The problem with the Big Ten is the timeline they set for themselves. So once you get the SEC schedule and the idea that they're going to start in late September, the SEC may not play football. I think they will. I think that's where they're headed. But they gave themselves the benefit of time a little bit to see what happens when kids got on campus, to see what happened with the NFL. You remember baseball at that time was having some real issues with the Marlins and Cardinals. And, you know, they gave themselves the benefit of time a little bit. And the Big Ten didn't do that with the September 5th start, even if they built in weeks later on. And I think that was, you know, having the release of the schedule and 6 days later, I mean, they put themselves in a spot. So he may have thought people were going to follow, but the other leagues had set themselves up not to have to make a decision right away. And so it would have been, if the other leagues also got the benefit of seeing the backlash against the Big Ten well before they had to make a decision. And the thing that we're all realizing is usually what changes decisions is political pressure.
Absolutely.
And what the political, this is so politicized and polarized that the politics in the regions where they are still playing is a political pressure to keep playing. And this is something where you can find medical reports that people think it's okay to play and all that stuff. So you can find, yeah, and I'm not saying the SEC and ACC and Big 12 don't have legitimate doctors who are telling them and they're not trusting them. I will say when Texas Tech keeps practicing through 21 cases, because by any health officer's estimation, that positivity rate on your roster is a little high. That is probably irresponsible. When you see Iowa State, which is reverse course now, go from allowing 25,000 fans in their opener in a state that's the largest outbreak in the country right now, and they only have a 60,000 seat stadium, I think it is. You do see some decisions some places where it doesn't make any sense. But a lot of it is politics, and this has been politicized early. And we're in this boat largely because of politics early. And this isn't a political podcast, but if at the very top, once it was decided and discovered, and as we learn more about the virus, the mask thing became important in terms of not spreading it. And that was realized. It was much more in the air than what you touch and all that sort of stuff. If right away leadership at the top had said, we got to nip this in the bud, we got to have schools back, we want to have sports, we want to have our lives back in the fall, wear a mask, socially distance, let's do this hard for a little bit, we wouldn't be in this situation. So to come out now and say, we ought to be playing is, or at least 57% of the country probably knows, is a little bit hypocritical.
Let's be real about this. It's all amplified politically right now because it's an election year. I think that's another thing that really needs to be taken into account with why things are pinballing and ping-ponging back and forth so much with this. This is an election year, a very divisive election year on both sides. And I think that, you see everybody trying to seize on talking points, both sides. I mean, that's the reality of politics creeping into sports. And, it's interesting to see that there's a certain contingent of people who love to tell us to stick to sports, but aren't telling the politicians to stick to politics. And so there's certainly, there's a lot of fever, a lot of emotion between the politicians trying to win votes, the coaches trying to win recruits, all these things. But let's face it, you could be naive to say that there's not politics in sports, because that's essentially what recruiting is. Recruiting is politicking for your program.
Yeah, circling back on the Iowa thing you talked about, Graham, the University of Iowa, they suspended all practices after 99 athletes tested positive for COVID-19. And throughout the entire school, it's over 1,000 cases now over the past couple of days. So, this was a school that was very vocal about playing in the fall. And I think one of the reasons we surmised that was because, Iowa, there's a lot of farmland there. And, we thought that maybe COVID-19 and coronavirus hadn't really got there, as big as in other cities like, Lansing or Detroit, for example. And obviously now that has kind of come to roost a little bit, at least in Iowa anyway.
Yeah. Well, the students came back in Ames and Iowa City and it was always going to hit there later. And, I'm curious where all this goes once we've been in school for 3 weeks. I'm curious where this will be once, you start getting position groups that are quarantined. But I'll be honest, if I have to bet one way or another, I think they are playing starting the season in the SEC, ACC, and Big 12.
Yeah, I think that's where we're at this point as well.
Something that in talking to MSU's president, Sam Stanley, I think that really jumps out at me in talking about the students coming back to campus and, programs shutting down and everything else is, here's a guy who I think quite rightly the Big Ten is relying on because he's an infectious disease expert. And one of the things he said was, and I asked him this, I said on a call a couple weeks ago, I said, how safe or unsafe is football right now? He said, we'd love to see the data. Well, that's the reality, that there hasn't been a football season in the middle of this disease since the virus, which is a novel virus, and they're trying to study in real time, That, so to me, and I've used this term in a lot of ways, you know, these athletes become guinea pigs right now for these studies. You know, what happens? You know, how, you know, and I think that comes down to what are the conferences risking? What are they willing to risk? What are the athletes willing to risk? It's, you know, it's unlike concussions. It's unlike, you know, broken bones or anything else that athletes deal with, because that affects you individually, whereas this virus affects the community. And one of the things in talking to disease experts is the community spread is the concern. Maybe not so much, are these guys going to pass it back and forth on the field, though there is, even Stanley admitted that, you know, having those offensive and defensive linemen really close together, there's a risk of transmissibility there. But, you know, how much can you keep them from the community at large? How much can you keep them from their families? About Matt Allen brought up a great point. Guys who were on Michigan State's team who were not wanting to play this year want to be able to see their families. They don't want to feel like they're putting them in harm's way. And, you know, it's a two-way street as well, because now if you do go see your family and they have something, well, then you risk bringing it back to your team and infecting them. So, you know, it's a different risk situation than anything that football, even as risky as football is in itself, that goes beyond the field factor.
Yeah, and there are lots. I mean, there is the unknown, and you're trying to protect athletes who may, you know, who want you to protect them. Although, you know, you could argue from a data standpoint that the transfer rule, the data is pretty clear at this point that kids who transfer don't usually wind up in better situations. So what's technically one of their rights might be like not right for them generally. And we're going to get to the one-time transfer at some point. And so, but I understand health and that's a little different, but what I think is interesting is these kids are still on campus. They're still working out, and yes, they may be in smaller groups and they don't have the piles playing football. But if you do get to rapid testing where you can test both teams the day before a game and have quick results, or however you do that, day of a game, and, you know, at that point, there's no real extra risk between the two teams, you're going to have a hard time saying that it's okay for them to play and not practice and be on campus and not play games. There are lots of other arguments for it, though. I would have been okay with this, and this is what's weird about the timing, too. Like, at Michigan State, they don't feel it's okay. They don't have students on campus. They basically, everybody they could possibly send home, they did. The classes are online. Now, there are kids off campus, and there are some in the dorms. And they waited until after that tuition payment, you know, hit, and after they said they were going to be there. And I think ethically that's understood financially, but pretty shameful. And you know, there are lots of feelings I have on that and what the schools should have done. But you could argue if a president said, look, we can't have students on campus, we're not playing sports. Like, we there's a threshold we have to be able to meet. If we can't reach that basic threshold of in-person classes, then what are we talking about here? It's college football. And for all the financial implications, just in terms of priority, it doesn't make sense. And that would have been one reasonable thing to say. But that's not what we've heard, and that's not what's been said. And so I think part of the problem is they haven't given, you know, a real clear, concise answer on what happened in the room where it happened, what they heard, when were they swayed, did they ever think they might play? Because I don't think they did. I think the biggest mistake the Big Ten made, other than their communication on this, was releasing the schedule. If they had never released the schedule, and they had said, we're going to, you know, based on the time when they were going to vote and decide this, they didn't need to. I think it would be a little different look as well.
We've talked about that before, false optimism. I think that's, you know, that's the inherent nature of sports is, you know, you're positive to keep your players and everybody else positive. But this isn't one of those situations where you're in control of it. I think some coaches have kind of come to grips with that. I think Mel Tucker has come to grips with that and been pretty eloquent in talking about it. And others continue, like Jim Harbaugh today, Wednesday, pushing, let's go, let's play right now. I mean, there's, you know, there's only so much you can do. But you know, my favorite news of the week, and this is this ex- this pretty much explains the duplicity that's going on here. The AFCA, the American Football Coaches Association, announced that their annual January meetings are going to now be held virtually because of COVID concerns. Well, these are the coaches who get paid the money and who go there to recruit new coaches and hobnob and all these other things. It's not safe for them to go into a convention, but it is safe for their players to play on the field and be in the community. There's a lot of mixed messages that are going on in a lot of different ways right now.
Yeah, that's not just college football. It's just the world in general. It feels like mixed messages.
It is
the theme
it
of the
is.
Past 7 months.
So one of the things that's worth bringing up, though, is because there's obviously a Michigan State contingent listening to this podcast. From a Michigan State football program perspective, I think not playing early this year right away is a total win. And I've heard that from people within the program too. They did not get a proper run up here. This was going to be, they needed this. This was, I think, going to be a tougher season. First of all, you don't have the non-conference games. You've got, you've got a lot of new parts all at once without getting the spring, without getting the real way of fall camp happens. A lot of things that made this difficult. I don't think they're heartbroken about having more time to implement their things in terms of off-season workouts, their structure, their plays, you know, figure things out. I don't think from an MSU football perspective that a delay is a bad deal for the beginning of the Mel Tucker era.
Yeah, not to mention that 400 years ago, all the way back in February, Michigan State was left in a bind after the coaches' convention having to look for a coach. You know, I mean, Mark D'Antonio's retirement timeline did not help and do Michigan State football any favors. I mean, you know, the February 4th retirement, I mean, to try and replace a coach at the Power 5 level there are very few instances you've heard or seen that for a retirement. And certainly put Michigan State in a bad situation. Then a month onto the job, Mel Tucker has to shut down his football program 4 days before practices start. I mean, they didn't have an off-season weight conditioning program. The guys were scattered around the country at their houses lifting tires and whatever else, buckets of bricks and whatever else they could find. So, yeah, you're right. And the fact that they only got, maybe 4 or 5 days worth of actual on-field work after being shut down for 2 weeks with a COVID outbreak within the program, you know, they were behind even getting to that September 5th date. So, you know, from a football standpoint, you're right. I mean, this benefits Michigan State without question. And I think even Mel Tucker has admitted that.
I think what we learned from all that was if you're going to put a retention bonus in somebody's contract, maybe not put it in February.
Or it was late January. But, yeah, certainly it is. It was right. You probably, put it in July if you really want.
From the school perspective, I understand why you put it that late, so that they're going to so they're not inclined to go. But in a situation where D'Antonio was in, you certainly gave him no time to try to find a coach.
Right, and you know, in hindsight, I think you know they probably should have, really, really pressed him on that. And if he was going to go, said we're going to give you the bonus anyway. The thing that's interesting about the timeline. Is I'm less, if this had been a normal year and we don't have it, I'm not as concerned about the timeline. It did put them under the gun finding a staff and how quickly they were going to be able to, but they were going to get a full spring practice with those guys and a full basic off season. It was always going to be hard first year just on the number of guys they lost and where you're replacing certain positions. But, you know, in the way the recruiting calendar has changed now, where so many of the recruits are signed anyway, by December, that, you know, obviously if you leave it Thanksgiving weekend and the coaching change happens, then he would have had a chance to shape a little of that recruiting class. But the way it is now, if D'Antonio had left right after the bowl game, Tucker was going to have very little influence anyway on the recruiting class this year. And so I don't know that it wasn't, obviously the timing wasn't ideal. I don't know in a normal year if it would have been quite so crippling, though.
Speaking of Michigan State football, let's talk a little about Mel Tucker and his recruiting. In late August, he landed his first four-star recruit in the 2021 class when he got a commitment from four-star New Jersey offensive lineman Gino Vandermark out of one of the New Jersey powerhouses. Chris, how important was it for Tucker to finally, after receiving, I think, 12 other commits, all of them three stars, to finally get that four-star guy?
Yeah, I think that from a perception standpoint, that's big. I think, in particular, that you're building it up front with a four-star guy. That's, you know, if you're able to get a four-star offensive defensive lineman, that kind of emphasizes this idea that you want to be tough. You want to be able to run the ball. You want to be that quote unquote relentless team. Vandermark certainly fits the bill of potentially being a mammoth tackle in the interior, or potentially being an outside tackle, or excuse me, a mammoth guard in the interior, or a tackle on the outside. He wants to be. They got Kevin Wigginton from New Jersey, so they've been mining that area. There's definitely interest, and I think back to Mark D'Antonio's first couple classes, and those early classes were filled with guys that were off the radar and two-star guys, and, three-star guys, and the fact that Mel Tucker's been getting three-star guys speaks to where the level that this program has come, but the fact that they still only have one four-star shows how much more needs to be done to try and sustain what D'Antonio built and take it to a next step.
Yeah, and Vandermark's high school teammate, the running back, hopefully I'm pronouncing right, Audric Esteme, he is rumored also to be heavily leaning toward Michigan State. So it would, if they can secure that commitment too, that'd be kind of a nice four-star teammate combo there for them. You were talking about the offensive linemen and their size. The thing I've noticed, and I'm sure maybe you have too if you looked at it, and the type of offensive lineman recruits that Tucker and his staff are going after. They're going after, bigger, high 290s, 300, 310-pound guys, whereas I think D'Antonio's staff, at least, in the later years, were going after 250, 260 guys that they kind of bulk up. It seems like they're trying to get that bulk there right away, then maybe trim them down or whatnot if they need to.
Yeah, and I think that in talking to Matt Allen last week, they're really, really jazzed and enthused, the offensive linemen, about working with Chris Kapilovich. And I think that, all these recruits are speaking to his strength as a recruiter and ability to sell his vision of what he wants Michigan State's run game to be. And there's no doubt that they're going with bigger, faster, and stronger kind of guys. At least the bigger part, the hope is that you can mold them into the faster and stronger guys when they get to campus. But that's got to be the staple. I mean, you saw the last couple of years how badly the injuries up front decimated what Michigan State was trying to do. I mean, they went 10-3 and didn't have any real changeover on the offensive line in the past 2 years. I think it was, 9 and 8 different combinations of starting groups over the 26 games. I mean, that's a lot. That's a lot. I mean, there's the lack of continuity, it affects the running game and it affects the passing game and everything else. But Kapilovich clearly is a guy that is out there and making some headway. And I think the whole staff is as well. I mean, I think they've been really creative on social media and they've done a lot of selling of the program. And I think Mel Tucker talked about that being, when everything got shut down, they realized they have to be salesmen for their own program. And I think they've started to be able to do that.
A beautiful segue, Chris. And speaking of social media, yesterday, Michigan State's coaching staff, Mel Tucker, Michigan State football account, and the guy who runs a lot of their social media stuff, they sent out a graphic yesterday regarding the name, image, and likeness stuff, and really kind of pushing the idea on recruits that if they come to Michigan State, the NIL part can be a big component, and Michigan State can provide a huge role in that. I don't think we have seen too many schools kind of try to go that route at this point. What were your guys' kind of thoughts on that?
Well, I'll say that I don't follow as many schools closely, so I don't, if North Carolina State was doing something similar, I would have no idea. So I don't know that to be true. I do think it's smart, though, from a branding standpoint, to put the emphasis Michigan State has on this. It's an important recruiting thing. I think in basketball, for example, and not everybody is going to be a Monty Bates. And so some towns, when all things are considered equal, are going to have advantages over others, some campuses, some conferences. But like Amani Bates is going to be perhaps, if he comes to Michigan State, the the first superstar of the name, image, and likeness era, and sort of what, you know, what he gets and what that means. I think it's going to be fascinating to watch, because it'll affect decisions on when kids leave, depending on how much they can make. I think it's going to, there are going to be some real negatives in terms of locker rooms and in terms of kids figuring out what their market value is, and that it's not that much, and that the scholarship is really about what they're worth, you know, and that's going to be disheartening at times. There can be some splintered locker rooms. I do not think college athletes will get as much done collectively moving forward once this starts, because this is a very individual thing. And once guys are in certain areas are able to take care of themselves, the willingness to sacrifice for something that may be unpopular to a sponsor or some sort of situation, I think will be harder for these guys. It's going to be very interesting to watch.
Yeah, and it's going to be something that evolves over time, and especially with it being the Wild West right up front. I thought Michigan State did a good job of getting out in front of it, because they're speaking in a language that the kids they're trying to attract no one understands. I mean, when one of your big things is promoting your brand in big letters directed right at kids about their Twitter and Instagram accounts, kids know that. Kids know that. I mean, every kid is doing their release of their top 15 or their top 6 and then making their commitment with heavily produced videos. These kids are savvy. They understand this. They understand the effect that it has. They see the likes and they see the followers pop up, and they know that there's a monetary value to that because their peers in some other areas are able to make money off that. But I think that there was other things too that Tucker, they've done that quietly up until Tuesday. And one of the things I think they was using the university's photographer to give these kids photos of themselves during practice, during games, little video clips and stuff that they can push out there. And it's entertaining. It's engaging. It sells themselves. And Michigan State saying, hey, you know, we've already got these resources in-house here. Go ahead and run with it. And, you know, certainly that's a change in strategy from a lot of the other things. I think you've seen more and more of that happening at Michigan State over the last couple of months since Mel Tucker took over. And I think that long-term that's going to benefit them on top of all of this. Cause I mean, Tucker talked about this, you know, this is something that he does, you know, he's one of those guys. I think someone asked him, you know, what Mel Tucker does, one of the players last week, and they said, well, I imagine the first thing he does is, you know, plan out his day and figure out what social media posts he's going to post. That, I mean, he's savvy. He gets it because that's how to sell your program right now.
Yeah, I think we talked about this before we started recording. Like, we've seen some of the recruits post the social graphic that says, my recruitment is officially shut down, and with the Michigan State stuff all over. And I'm guessing, you know, the social media staff just sends that to everybody, and they hope they post. I've never seen that from other schools doing that. And I just think that's so interesting. I don't know if it's good or bad or anything, or I personally, I think it's sort of weird, but I mean, it's a different approach. And I think when you're Michigan State, you're looking for a different approach, and maybe that works for certain people.
It's bridging the generation gap is what it's doing between a 48, 50 year old coach and 18, 17 year old kids.
And frankly, these adults to some degree have had this opportunity. I mean, maybe not in social media the same way, but they've had the opportunity to live in a world where you can market yourself. And some of them will have had experience with this. And what's going to be fascinating is once this becomes available, you know, when you see every backup linebacker's got, you know, marketing the hell out of himself, and everybody's going, well, so what, man? Like, I don't, you know, I think it's going to be fascinating to watch. And I hope that,
you know what I got to say to that? Here's what I got to say to that. Kyler, who would have told, if I would have told you at the beginning of the 2013 season that Kyler Ellsworth would have an autograph signing after the year and people would turn out and get his autograph, would you have believed it?
Right. No, no. You know,
I mean, and the same goes with the guys like Jalen Watts Jackson. I mean,
correct.
You know, the one moment, that one shining moment can, in the college level, because of the platform on national TV, because of the amplification of these games and highlights clips and everything else over the years, even a guy like that, like Kyler Ellsworth or Jalen Watts Jackson, while they're not going on to make millions of dollars in their professional careers. They still got a steady stream of income for the rest of their lives off of one moment. That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, that's really what it is.
No, and they ought to be able to take advantage of it earlier than they do. And I'd be curious to see to what degree that income still exists, because now they can, of course, take advantage of it. But it's, what's going to be fascinating is in the locker room, the resentment and the feelings that go on. And you know, let's think about last year's Michigan State running back situation. And say you're the starting running back at the beginning of the year, like a Connor Hayward. And not only do you lose your starting job to a freshman, but you lose a sponsorship deal, or you lose, you know what I mean? Or you lose something that you lose the cachet that allows you to do certain things. I think that sort of stuff is going to get real weird, real, you know, not ideal. I don't think any of this is ideal. But I think it's probably fair and I would love to see. So I don't know. I don't want to go down this road, because it is. I don't want to philosophically go where I'm going on this, because it's a whole different debate. But I do think there are going to be some hearts broken. I think what players get overall, and what many of them know, is a great deal. I am about tired of folks in the media and anywhere acting like these are unpaid labor, scholarship is nothing. If you are a kid who could not get into college anywhere, it is not for your football ability, based on your scores, your grades, and you get to go to a good university, have it entirely paid for, be pretty well treated while you're there in terms of tutoring and classes. And now, and granted, I think schools need to do more in terms of lifetime education and making sure these, if you're going to accept somebody who may not be ready for college, make sure they are developed even beyond college and they're still helped. But and you're given, you know, if you're an out-of-state kid, the equivalent of like $140,000 in tuition and now cost of attendance, and you wouldn't be able to go to school anyway. It's not a bad deal for a lot of places and for a lot of kids. And are there exceptions to it? Absolutely. But I think a lot of kids are gonna learn that the hard way.
Okay, let's move on to Twitter questions here. I apologize in advance for the first question, because we get this, I think, every time we ask for Twitter questions. But Rocky Labar did talk to the media last week, so I thought I would go ahead and include it.
Bill, you did not put this question in
there. I did. This comes from Hamza. If we somehow end up getting Big Ten football this year, who do you guys foresee starting at QB? Considering there was no spring ball, does Rocky get the green light because he has some sort of game experience?
You go first, Chris.
No, me go first. I'm going to go out on a limb and say, yes, he does get the ball first, but I think it'll, to me, and this is all spitballing again, because they've had practices in pads, shorts, and jerseys and not in pads, and they've rarely had any full team workouts yet to kind of build that timing and rapport. I think he gets the first nod, but I think it could be a situation like, if you remember back in that early 2013 season, where guys just, you know, rotate in and out trying to figure out who works best. I think you have to kind of go that and kind of ride a hot hand and go from there.
Yeah,
I'm actually taking a stance on that.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you, Chris. I would add to what Chris is saying, and I don't disagree, that it's also, if you got a short run up and they've had it, this isn't what they, I mean, when we were asked this question originally, right, we thought there was going to be a spring practice in the summer and a regular quarterback competition, and you haven't gotten a lot of that. So you've got one guy who's got substantially more experience. Is an older guy, been in the locker room longer. They put him out in front of people more, which is telling. I also think it's easier to go to the older guy first and then replace him than to do the other way around. And struggles. And so if this is a year where you may have some struggles, you may go through some tough times. You're a guy who's been in Big Ten games, he's had things go wrong, he's had some moments. Whether he's the best, you know, you may not have a clear picture whether he's truly the best quarterback, even if you're Michigan State's coaches at the beginning, but he might be the right guy to start the season. And then how he does, you and how other guys are looking, you adjust from there. I think it's easier to go that way than he's not the incumbent, but to bench the older guy. Younger guy struggles, loses confidence. You go to the older guy who you already beat up. Then you've got a guy who's unhappy. I mean, just in terms of a happiness perspective and trying to keep confidence up, and a younger guy doesn't start the job with the job, he's not likely to just say that's it. Whereas an older guy, you might lose entirely.
Yeah, previously on this podcast, I've said that I thought Peyton Thorne would be the starter for game one, but I am going to officially go on the record in reverse course and say I think it is Rocky Lombardi for all the reasons we've all talked about.
And you wanted Rocky Lombardi over...
Lombardi over the Lurkey. I know I was... Yeah. Famous pod, yeah. Famous
moments
of podcast.
I think the other thing, too, is, hey, everything's been so disjointed. At least you've got a guy who understands what it's like to prepare to be a starter on a game day. I think that's got to be taken into account.
And, you know, physically, he's held up. You know, and he's taken the pounding. He's been in pressure situations. I mean, you know, and to the point we were talking about, he's failed and succeeded at the college level. I mean, he was a hero after that Purdue game. And he was pretty blunt about the fact that later on he didn't actually play that well, but Purdue's defense was so atrocious that, I mean, he said that was like his worst game of the year, and it was the game he was hailed as a hero for. And then we've seen him struggle mightily in a game they really needed to win, you know, against Nebraska, and at other times. And so he's got some tough, thicker skin too at this point. I think there are just a lot of reasons that would probably make sense. And while there's more time to evaluate these guys now, but if say they were playing January or November, I think I think my answer would at least probably stick then.
All right, David Zandi has two questions. I'm going to ask his second question first because I think this is what everybody wants to hear. Kirk Cousins' hot take on COVID. Would love your thoughts. I'll set the stage here. Kirk Cousins appeared on the 10 Questions with Kyle Brandt podcast. I think it was recorded earlier this summer, I believe in July, and he had some comments about the coronavirus. He said, the exact quote was, "If I die, I die." And, you know, he kind of... It was just one line out of a pretty long comment he said, and he was talking about how he did say he understood people, he would wear masks to support other people, but at the same time, his worry on a scale from like 1 to 10 was 0.0001. So it was some weird comments from him. What are your guys' thoughts on that?
Well, I think I'm going to keep mine short. I think that the fact that he did say that he respects other people's concerns and that he does wear a mask, I think that's the important takeaway here. But at the same point, you know, not worrying about this, and this is coming from a father of young children myself, so I'm taking this in a personal realm with this. I know he has young kids, and I met them. You know, I would hope that he tries his best to make sure that he keeps himself safe for them. Because again, this isn't about sometimes that's clearly a sign of his faith that he believes that, you know, everything will have its way. And, you know, if he dies, he dies. This exact quote, you know, and there's obviously a lot of reasons for that. You know, he's a very, very outspoken Christian. And I kind of get where he's coming from with that. But at the same point, you also have to take care of yourself to take care of your children, too.
Yeah, I'm a little conflicted because there's a part of me that really thinks, you know, if for a lot of people, we're obviously polarized and there's different opinions on this. And if everybody with a different opinion followed that example and just respected, even if by the off chance the masks make a big difference, had the respect for their fellow mankind and did that, we'd be in a much better place right now. There's also part of me that knows he has a pretty large platform. And you know, sets an example, and I just don't, you know, and I've seen all sorts of reaction to this today. People saying, you know, there's more science that says masks don't matter. No, there's not. That's not what scientists are saying. It's not. That's just not. I'm about sick of that. And yes, there was a unfortunate comment by Anthony Fauci early on when he was trying to protect he was trying to state two points. One, that masks weren't the end all be all. And secondly, that they needed to preserve equipment for people. And that everybody jumps on that. And And there's also, you know, and I know there are things on the CDC website, and we're all in a spot now where, unfortunately, we can't completely trust the CDC, which sucks, which is the first time in our lifetime. And it's ridiculous. There's a lot of ridiculousness going on. And so I didn't love it from that standpoint, that he has a big platform and it's not helpful, that he's sort of a COVID denier, so to speak. It drives me nuts when people who have faith in God don't have faith in science. That's just a general, as somebody who's raised an Episcopalian and has friends and family on both sides of the aisle and all sorts of religions, that's always been one of the things that just bothered me.
David Zandi's first question: how much of an issue would the football thing be under Delaney than Warren? How much does race play into it?
I have no idea what that question even means.
So is the question like, because they're not respecting Kevin Warren because he's a black commissioner?
I think that's the second part of the question. Yes, I think the first part of the question is just about if Delaney was still the commissioner, would there be as much blowback to the Big Ten?
Delaney might have more control. Like, I mean, I think they would have been better off with Delaney just because he, you know, from people who seem to understand the dynamic better than I did, he would have been able to say to people, hey, we're all going to be in one accord on this. I don't know if he would have communicated a whole lot better or not. And I don't know if, I don't know. I mean, Kevin Warren's an impressive dude. I don't know that people don't respect him, but he certainly doesn't have the long-term relationships that Delaney did.
Yeah, you cannot compare Jim Delaney after 20-some years as commissioner to Kevin Warren his first few months on the job. I think it's just a baseless comparison here. And Jim Delaney never had to go through something like this. I mean, the closest thing that, the biggest things that he had to deal with and broker throughout his tenure between the presidents and the athletic directors were expansion. And this isn't expansion. This is a lot different than that.
All right, Rick Tweeters ask, when talking program Big Ten greats, is there a more underappreciated guy than Kalen Lucas? MSU was Lucas torn Achilles away from the title in 2010.
I don't know. Like, he certainly is. He does get overshadowed. And I probably, he was one of the guys that I may have underappreciated on my rankings. I think what happens with Lucas is when he returned, he was part of that team that, you know, the 2010-11 team that was sort of a disaster. And so that's also on his resume. But, yeah, no, there's no question. I mean, you're talking about a guy who was a two-time Big Ten Player of the Year and just an incredible point guard on, he probably does.
One of the other guys I think that you could probably throw in there maybe, and it's from an injury standpoint, would be Del Monroe. I think, you know, that first part of his career, he was looking like he was going to be a big-time player, and then the injury got him, and, you know, that maybe limited what some of those teams could have done.
Carl asks, which MSU basketball player in recent memory have you been the most wrong about? I was convinced Aaron Harris would be the piece to put MSU over the top.
That's a really good question from Carl. And Joshua Langford's story isn't done, and he's turned into a really good player, and he was having a great junior year. And so I don't know what it'll be, but I thought his freshman impact was going to be bigger than it was. I really loved his game. And I thought he had some old man game, and he was a good freshman. I probably overhyped him, more than he should have been, and expected probably too much, out of him. And so I would say that is probably the one. You know, Foster Lawyer certainly I thought would have more of an impact. I think a lot of us misread that and then saw pretty quickly that he was going to struggle, but coming out of high school, thought he would have more offensive success than he has.
All right, Spartan Mello with the last two questions here. Going to hockey first. Coach Cole seems to be having consistently strong recruiting classes for hockey. How long do you think it will take for him to be competitive at the national level again?
It's a good question, because for a while last year, they looked like they were just about on the cusp of the NCAA tournament, and then the year didn't end as well. But they were competitive, and there have been strides each year. They brought in some, you're right, on the recruits. This year will be weird. I don't know if or when hockey is going to be played. But I definitely think the program's in the right direction. Like, you can see tangible results, and he's not somebody who oversells it or undersells it. It's tough because they went through such a bad stretch and they missed on the Tominassis hire, and there were moments then where it was like, could this be happening? And so it's just been so long that people are running out of patience. But I do think that they are just about there where they should be consistently in the conversation for an NCAA tournament bid.
All right, last question. We saw Iowa cut four sports. Is there talks about that happening at state? If so, what sports would be likely cut?
You know, I've not heard that yet. But I do think sports like the swimming, which they don't have great facilities for, wrestling, sports like that would be the ones that would be most likely to be cut. And you got to keep in mind the numbers have to add up from a Title IX perspective. Wisconsin, I believe, years ago cut baseball. I don't think MSU would do that. But saying that, I mean, these are unprecedented times, and how they're going to come up with the money to get through this, I don't know. And some of those sports, though, don't save all that much money because they're not all that expensive, but they certainly don't bring a whole lot of money in. My hope is they creatively figure out how to get through this well enough that they don't have to do that.
Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed that MSU does not cut any sports. All right, that'll wrap up this week's podcast. Thank you for joining us for this edition of Spartan Speak, a production of the Lansing State Journal, Detroit Free Press, and the USA Today Network. If you enjoy this podcast and the work surrounding it, please consider subscribing. You can follow our coverage at lsj.com, freep.com, and on Twitter at Graham_Couch, at Chris Solari, at Phil_Friend, and at LSJ Green White. Thanks for listening.